Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Sat on a tree, down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, "Where shall we our breakfast take?" With a down, dairy, 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 down, down.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of the Three Ravens podcast. We're on a break at the moment, researching and writing our fourth series, but to fill the gap, this is the second of three new compilation episodes containing a trio of stories from across our earlier series. We've entitled this episode Three Horrors because it contains three of our creepier stories, including our Devon story, The Hairy Hands of Dartmoor, our Staffordshire story, The Children of Cannock Chase, and our Derbyshire story, The Boggarts of Arbour Low. If you'd like to support the podcast and access all of our episodes ad-free, as well as tons of additional content like monthly exclusive episodes, episodes of the Three Ravens Film Club, our newsletters, stories as text versions and more, do consider signing up to our Patreon at patreon.com/3ravenspodcast. Speaking of which, we'll be recording our new Three Ravens Film Club episode next Monday. So if you've watched The Devil Rides Out and would like to share your thoughts about it, then email them through to 3ravenspodcast@gmail.com by the 25th of March for inclusion in that episode. And if you haven't watched The Devil Rides Out yet, go on! Do yourself a favour. It's a classic. Otherwise, for our archive of all past episodes and expanded information for each episode, as well as our shop full of Three Ravens merch, please visit our website at 3ravenspodcast.com. We'll speak to you soon, and in the meantime, we'll start spinning our yarns right after this.
I shouldn't have driven that road, and I knew it before I set out. Trouble is, men in my family were an inquisitive bunch, always poking our noses in where they don't belong, see? Most families say that's women's business, but not for us. And had I not been born such a nosy sort of fellow myself, I never would have met Gilchrist. And if I'd never met him, well then, I'd be free to ponder rather than knowing the truth. There's some benefits to letting some questions be. It all came about because of my Uncle John. Folk from round my way, they don't move. We're born and live and work and die in the same ground our fathers knew. I had a cousin once who moved to that there London and he never came back. Some cities are big enough to eat people up whole, they say. Boy, they must cobblers. I've been to Bristol and it's nothing special. But lots of things I once thought was cobblers I'm not so sure on. Anyway, as for John, he married a lass from Cornwall and moved to Torbay. Well, to my father and brother, that made him as good as dead, fit only for exchanging Christmas cards. But I called him up, partly on account of when I was a boy, he showed me a trick with a silver penny, making it disappear and run through his knuckles like water, which made me think of him fondly. When he died, he'd already been a widower, and his estate, such as it was split up, as is the way with these things, and I suppose I was as much a son to John as anyone, and was appointed executor. So I was to Torbay, that wet summer, to settle John's affairs, meaning I was leaving home for the first time in many years, all on my lonesome. Now everybody round our way knows the tales of the Hairy Hands. Their stories going back to my father's father's time of that so-called haunted highway. Of horses and buggies driven off-road, people dying, all sorts. But the big one that all recall was the incident with Dr. Ernest H. Elby. He was known, for he was medical officer at Dartmoor Prison, looking after all sorts when many folk wouldn't go within 10 mile of the place. But one day, he took his wife out on his motorcycle in 1921. She were in the sidecar with the two daughters of the prison governor. It said that they were out driving down the B3212. His hands were then grabbed by a pair of strong, calloused fists with a grip like iron. He yelled to his wife, and though she survived, as did the two girls, Dr. Elby lost control of the bike and crashed, dying of a fractured skull. That's perhaps the most famous death on that stretch of road, which runs from Potts Bridge to Two Bridges. But there's been a dozen cases or more in the papers alone of such strange occurrences along that thoroughfare. Army soldiers, journalists, young couples, women driving alone. The incidents stretch out for over a century. Used to make the news, but less so now. People always said the coppers round there hushed it up and made out folk had so many accidents on account of being unfamiliar with the camber of the road. I didn't believe it, but, well, now I do. Plus, nobody round there calls the bridge Cherry Brook, which is the name on the map. They call it Hairy Hands Bridge because the stories are always the same. People assailed by mighty, hairy hands that come out of the dark, stinking of sulphur, trying to drag them off onto the moor. Now, I can't have been the first to look at a road map and think, well, I could go this away, but though that way's a bit longer, I wonder if I might take the winding route and make something out of the trip that's more than just a journey from A to B. So off I went, driving my old Volvo down the B3212, listening to the radio, Dartmoor whizzing by to my left and right. But I made an error, you see, thinking I'd have better luck seeing something by night. You know how it is with spooks and bogies and the like. Nighttime is when they're abroad, or so people say. And after I'd passed through Potts Bridge, which doesn't have a street light, I realised that all I could see outside the car was rough-edged shadows of heath and heather stretching on and on to the horizon. It was a misty night and cold, and the old Volvo was no good at keeping the weather out. I was driving in my old wax jacket, which I pulled close about me, seeing my breath in front of my face. But to encourage whatever horror I imagine there might be out there, I killed the radio and drove on in silence, just the rattle of the engine and the sounds of the tires for company. Well, that and the thundering of my heart. Must have been sometime around midnight, which is just as I planned it, only as I sped down that famous road, headed towards that famous bridge, I saw a light up ahead waving me down. I slowed the car and came to a stop by the side of the road, and I could see by my headlights an old fella wearing a rough old coat with torn pockets, a waistcoat, flat cap, and walking boots that came up to the ankle. He was holding a torch, one of those with power enough to shine up and light the clouds, and he shone it right in my face, making me squint. Wasn't until he was at my window that I got a good look at him. He was ruddy-faced, maybe with weather, maybe with drink, and he had wild white hair poking round the flat cap on his head, and he was out of breath, gasping. He tapped on the driver's side window with his torch, quickly. Tap, 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 and I wound it down an inch or two. "Where are you two, then?" he said. He was a good old boy, that was clear as glass, looking something like a Lord's gamekeeper down on his luck. He kept looking round him, shining his torch, and when he spoke, his breath smelled of whiskey and old tobacco smoke. "Editor Torbay," is what I said, and he looked at me with his grey-blue eyes and an upturned lip and a slow nod that said to me that, well, he knew what I was about. "Down this stretch of road, at this time of night, pull the other one," he replied. I had to grin, because he'd caught me rubbernecking fair and square, but he didn't rub it in. "You're not the first," he said, fiddling with his pocket, "and you won't be the last, I'd wager, but do me a favour now, if you wouldn't mind. I need to get back up to the Warren House Inn, and sharpish. You passed right by it a minute ago. Sorry to trouble you, but it's a matter of some urgency." He strolled round to the passenger side, as if I'd agreed to his request, and slightly taken aback, I did open the door for him, and he clambered in, pulling out an old mobile phone with the battery pack held on with sticking plasters. "I'd be quick about it if I were you," he said, punching numbers into his phone. "Elsewise, what you came to see may just come and see you, and do yourself a favour, wind that window up." I obliged and put the car in gear and set about turning in the road, but just as I did, I caught at the edge of my nose a smell that made me think maybe my new passenger had had some kind of accident. But he caught it too, and aged as he was far from decrepit. "Speed it up now, lad, would you?" he said, looking about the car and over his shoulder. Then he was pressing the mobile phone to his ear. "Yeah," he said. "Malcolm, hurry up, you silly goose." And then he ended the call and locked the door on his side. It was then that I heard a thump on my windshield. I was midway through reversing when it happened, swinging the steering wheel left and right, my feet hopping between the pedals, one hand on the gear stick. But when I heard that sound, I turned and looked at it, and there it was, a wide palm of a hand pressing down on the window glass. I felt my eyes widen and my mouth fall open, but I had no idea what to say. Only then a second hand thumped down on the window shield again, palm down, bang, fingers spread, long nails scratching at the glass. I just sort of stopped and stared, and then the old fella reached over, whacked on the windshield wipers, and gave me a mighty nudge. "Drive," he said, and I did, watching as the wipers battered those hands on the glass, which tumbled away as I put my foot down and hightailed it out of there. We roared back up the misty road, and I don't think I said a thing. It wasn't until we got to the Warren House Inn that the old fella tapped the dashboard, saying, "Here we are, just pull up any place." I did, stopping the car, and the old bloke hopped out and pulled from his coat something like an old shepherd's club. You know, the kind made from blackthorn with a knobbed head for cracking skulls. And without shutting the passenger door, he wandered round the vehicle, the club raised, and then when he was happy, he tucked it back into his coat and opened my door for me. "Time for a drink," he said, standing by as I got out of the car, and he closed the doors, fiddling about with a length of string he wore about his neck. Eventually, he pulled it out of his clothes, revealing an old iron key, which turned out was a key to the pub's front door. "You know," he continued, "the fire in this inn has been burning constantly since 1845. An important date, 1845. What will you have?" He walked in, and though the fire was there, burning in the grate, it was otherwise empty. He turned some of the lights on and made his way round the bar, which had me thinking he owned the place, but he didn't. So when he explained his name was Gilchrist, and that the men of his family had a key as a favour for the duties they performed out on the moors. He poured me a stiff scotch and one for himself, and he beckoned me to sit on a chair by the bar while he talked. "You see," he said, 1845 is when the gunpowder factory opened." He spoke as if I knew this already, but it was all news to me. "It's called the powder mills now, but back when George Frayne had teams of folk working, combining saltpeter, sulfur and charcoal, you know much about gunpowder?" I said I didn't, and he carried on. "Well, it used to be called alchemy, all that. And later came dynamite, but back then, gunpowder was how you blew into mine shafts. And you know, there's tin all through these parts, along with other metals and ores. So much so, if you stand by Cherry Brook with a compass, it's likely to go haywire. But old George Frayne didn't think too brightly about where he put his gunpowder factory, because not a stone's throw to the west is Bellever Tor. Ever seen Bellavator? I shook my head and he sipped his whiskey, talking to me like I was a child. Bellavator is an ancient place, 5,000 year old or more. Used to be the start of the Lich Way. Know what one of those is? I smiled then because it's old-timer. He knew I didn't have a Scooby-Doo. Back before there were a church at Widdicombe where people could hold funerals, the bishops of Exeter made folk from here walk their dead down a ways from Bellavator to Lidford Tor, then from White Barrow to Coffin Wood and on to St. Petrarch's. And all along that way, holy men would wait. This is Saxon times. They called them seers, and they'd guard the lich way from spirits and pixies and keep an eye on the souls who lost their way along the route. It's a holy place, Bellavator, but George Frayne didn't get two monkeys. He used to test his gunpowder on the rocks thereabouts, on the kists and the cairn circles, and some who worked for him didn't like it. He thought he was waking the dead, you see. Gilchrist poured himself another scotch, but I barely touched mine, and no sooner had he poured than he tipped his second dram down his big pink gullet. One of the lads working for him, Jethro Hamlin, was a bear of a man. Huge, over 6 feet tall, with hands like... well, with big, hairy, strong hands. And Jethro was born a Cullen folk. His hands were craftsman's hands, and his mother had taught him all the wisdom she'd been taught and some. And George Frayne, he took advantage. You had Jethro working on all sorts, using chemicals and metals and what have you, despite Jethro saying how the powder tests were making the spirits upset. Gold will make men do strange things. Ain't that the truth, I replied, holding my drinking glass. Thing is, Gilchrist went on, one day Jethro Hamlin's aunt died, leaving Jethro her cottage up by Huckabee Farm, and so Jethro told George Frayne he'd be moving on. Frayne, well, he didn't like that and lost his temper, so Jethro came here, had a drink, and waited till dark. But he forgot something important. Then there was a sound that made me jump out my skin. It came from behind me, a clanking of metal and heavy footsteps. "Right there, Gilchrist," came a voice. "Right there, Malcolm," he replied. I turned and saw a young man, not 30, I'd wager, dressed in a policeman's uniform. The clanking sound was on account of the thing he was carrying on his back, which looked to me for all the world like an old weed sprayer of some sort. You know, the kind you wear, with piston rods and a tube made of rubber connected to a valve and pressure gauge. It was cast in brass and dented all over with leather straps and nozzles here and there. So, Gilchrist continued, what Jethro Hamlin had forgot was his tools, Malcolm interrupted, setting down the sprayer which clonked on the flagstone floor. Yeah, thanks, Mal, Gilchrist said. You can go now, and thanks for fixing her. I'll stay, said Malcolm. I like this story. All right, but you keep quiet, because I'm the one telling it. He turned back to me, the orange glow from the old fire reflecting in his eyes. And so, after dark, Jethro Hamlin went back to get his tools, what he'd left at the gunpowder factory late that night. But he'd had a few by then, and he was wearing his hobnail boots, Malcolm said. Aye, Gilchrist replied, rolling his eyes. And button it, Malcolm, just because your mum and my Susan are friends doesn't mean I won't come round there and give you a hiding. Malcolm smiled, reaching about the bar and pouring himself a half of dark ale. Thing is, Gilchrist said, when on the factory floor, all the workers had to wear boots wrapped in rope in case of the nails in their shoes sparking, which is just what happened to Jethro Hamlin. Whole place went up like the 5th of November, didn't it, Gilchrist? Yes, Malcolm, it did. The buildings Frayne had built were at safe distance from one another, and each had a flimsy roof which carried explosions upwards. But the spark from Jethro Hamlin's boots caused a cataclysmic blast which blew him to pieces. People saw for miles around and came running, but it wasn't until the next day they found what was left of Jethro Hamlin. Malcolm, who by then had sat down beside me, put his glass down and extended his forearms, wiggling his fingers and crossing his eyes. poking his tongue out of his mouth. "His hairy hands," he said. And Gilchrist, right annoyed, bopped the lad's policeman's hat right off his head. "Nobody knows what happened next," Gilchrist said, rinsing his glass and setting it out to dry. "Or understands it. Maybe it was a cairns where his hands landed. Maybe it was the spirits from the Lichway, woken up by the blast. Or maybe it was on account of all the chemicals that got into Jethro Hamlin's skin from all those years of alchemy and potion craft. Either way, people started to notice. Taps on the door at night, scratching on the window panes, scuttling shapes darting about the moorland in the dark. I think I must have narrowed my eyes then, taken aback. It all seemed so far-fetched, but Gilchrist was telling the story like it wasn't just true, but a chore to tell it. What I learned later was, somehow, the hands out there, they breed with one another. Most of the time it's not a problem, especially in summer. They keep to Bellever Woods where it's damp. They can catch birds and burrow into the ground, seeking out rabbits and the like. But every once in a while, they scrabble and scratch and dig their way through the earth, making new ways underground, out towards a river or someplace. "Tell him about the campers," Malcolm said, smiling. "That's why we have designated camping zones, you know. Special safe spots for fishing, too. In 2008, a couple thought they'd pitch a tent on the banks of East Dart, and then, middle of the night, a whole swarm came and tore their campsite to pieces. Pretty woman she was, but she lost an eye." Gilchrist nodded to me, indicating I should drink up, but I looked at Malcolm in his police uniform. "I'm driving," I said, and Malcolm waved me off like it was nothing. "Me too," he replied, clinking his glass against mine. "Bottoms up, and if you do come back to camp, I'd stay in a caravan." We both drank, and Gilchrist carried on, taking out his pipe and filling it with tobacco from a leather pouch, leaves of it spilling across the bar. "Anyway," he said, "you've come on one of those nights they like, when the mists are out. And I was doing my rounds, walking about just to check they were staying where they're meant to stay, but then, you won't believe it, Mal, they're back all over Bellever Tor again." "Oh, no," Malcolm said. "We get tourists, sir." "Yeah, well, honestly," Malcolm continued, "ever since that newspaper man, Rufus Endell, people never come to stay here. They're scared. They drive on through like bats out of hell." Gilchrist struck a match, lit his pipe. Then, with our glasses rinsed, he approached the fire in the grate, burn into one side of the room, and pulled the great brass tank nearby. He primed it, yanking the lever, then turned the tap on its top, leaning the head of the sprayer down towards the flames. "Oh, well done, Mal. You may be thick as mincemeat, but there's not a metal worker in all Devon with half your skill." The fire leapt up and flickered at the end of the spout of the sprayer, and Gilchrist sucked on his pipe, exhaling smoke from the smiling corners of his mouth. "Special solution in there," Malcolm said under his breath, nodding at the canister. "Best by the vicar and all." "Only one thing they can't abide," Gilchrist said, taking his pipe from his mouth and pointing it at me. "And that's fire. Holy cleansing flame. So this," he tapped the tank, "ding, ding, made by my grandfather, is what we use to keep him at bay. And if you like, seeing as you came here to see him, you can keep close by if you want and watch on while we clear him off." I don't know why I agreed. Might have been the whiskey. But we went in convoy, Malcolm first and me and Gilchrist following on. And after that, we parked up a little way off. Malcolm brought out something he called chum. Looked like meat and smelled terrible, either way. And then I watched on as the pair walked about through the mist, all about the ruins of the old powder mills and round Bellever Tor, herding those creatures in the dark. Nobody can quite imagine the sound a hand makes when it screams. Honestly, it's impossible to describe. But the smell of them burning, the smell of the hair, most of all, something I'll never forget. Still, I did see some of them up close, the hairy hands. Must have been hundreds they burned that night, each slightly different from the last, calloused and scabbed, some with long nails curling over, some with stubs where digits must have been lost. And for all my inquisitive nature, I ended up holding my nose that night, protecting it from the stink. Anyways, that's how I met Gilchrist, and he's a good bloke, really. We still exchange Christmas cards.
Rain rattled against the windscreen, too heavy and fast for the wipers to clear. They left wide smears in their wake, making it almost impossible to see through. Lily crawled the patrol car down the deserted lane, unable to go any faster. If she had to give chase, she'd be putting herself at risk, especially as the road was littered with broken-edged potholes which would bounce the car and make the suspension shudder. She shouldn't be out on her own. They weren't ever supposed to be, but they were always understaffed, and the chief superintendent had called them all in to explain that the budget cuts meant there might be occasions when the second officer would actually be at the other end of the radio and not in the car. Budget cuts were all very well, but they didn't account for officers' shift patterns, which meant more often than not, Lily was left alone. This was the graveyard shift in more ways than one, slowly zigzagging her way around the narrow lanes, crisscrossing Cannock Chase Forest, headlights dipped, watching for anything, really. Cars exhibiting any unusual behaviour. Don't stop everyone, the chief inspector had stressed. Or any sign of strange activity at the edges of the forest. Don't go into the forest alone at night. So far, Lily hadn't seen a single car, and the trees were so thickly clustered at the edges of the dark forest that she would have been hard-pressed to spot any kind of activity, strange or otherwise. It was dangerous, being alone, and if there was any trouble, Lily was under strict instructions to call for backup immediately. Patrick's patrol was in Milford, so he could screech down to Cannock Chase quickly enough if Lily needed him, or she could go to him. Actually, Lily had volunteered for the Cannock Chase patrol. It was Friday night, and she didn't much fancy being verbally abused or vomited on outside the walkabout in Litchfield. Besides, she'd made sergeant last year, and the drunks' rescue service was for junior constables. She would much rather be here, despite the dreary dark night and the lashing rain. And yet she didn't think she was doing much good. She felt in that instinctual lower gut way which had got her into hot water in the past that Cannock Chase Forest was the place. They hadn't had the resources to comb through it without a single solid piece of evidence. But Lily was sure that if they'd had a couple of dog units and an uninterrupted week, they would find something. After all, both bodies had been found in ditches surrounding the forest, although on different sides. The first, Caroline Blackwater, had been discovered at the side of the A51, and the second, Alba Johnson, near the golf club on the Rudgley Road. DCI Harris said there was no evidence, but as far as Lily was concerned, the forest had to be the key. Where else would the killer have been able to do the things he'd done without somebody seeing or hearing? She rolled down the window, peering into the dark forest. There had to be something. She had to find something. For those poor little girls. To stop there ever being any others. She knew. And the deep part of herself, which throbbed with self-loathing in the middle of the night when she couldn't sleep for thinking about it, that there would be another one, because they hadn't caught him yet. When they'd found Caroline, everyone hoped that it would be a one-off, but Alba's body, with the exact same injuries, had proved them wrong. Lily slammed on the brakes, jarring her lower back and making the car's underside grind along the road, because she could see a child, reflected in the wing mirror, standing at the edge of the forest. How had she driven past her? The girl must have only just emerged. Lily couldn't quite make her out through the rain, but she could see that she was wearing something white, like a nightdress. The brake lights shining on her made it appear doused in red. Lily leapt from the car, leaving the engine running, and made her way back down the lane towards the girl. "Hello?" she called. "Police! It's all right, I'm here to help!" The rain buffeted Lily, soaking her face and hands and getting under her hat. She squinted, but she couldn't see the child anymore. Had she gone back into the forest? Surely she wouldn't have done. She looked small, only about 6 or 7 years old, Lily thought, though she'd only seen her for a moment. "Police!" she called again. "Please step forward if you can. I'm here to help." "Don't go into the forest alone at night." The chief inspector's words came back to her just as she was about to step off the road and into the oozing black mud of Cannock Chase. He'd spoken to Lily particularly, giving her a look which said he knew that she would if she thought it necessary. She'd been on the receiving end of his rage and almost had a caution for going haring off doing her own thing, contrary to orders. She'd caught the woman running a drug ring out of the back of her chain of nail salons, though, so the telling off hadn't been too heated. Lily shone her torch into the woods, but she could see nothing except trees and vegetation. Then she put her foot on something and swore softly when it gave way with a wet crunch. Shining the torch down, she saw that she'd trodden on the rain-soaked, half-rotten carcass of a deer. There was a spot of blood on its cream front, and the back legs were broken. She wiped her shoe on the verge and went back to the car, shutting the doors and flipping the central locking. Her hands were shaking. 10:45, she said into the radio. "Deer carcass on the Slitting Mill Road. Over." How many too late nights had she had to think a dead deer was a little girl needing help? Too many, and far too many on this case alone. When was her next day off? This time, Lily told herself, she would actually use her day off to rest, instead of trying to clean the flat, do the shopping, get a haircut, and catch up with 4 old friends. Her radio buzzed, making her jump. 10:99, wanted a beer, a smoke, and an umbrella, please. Over. Patrick's cheery voice came out of the radio in Lily's lap. She smiled because they weren't meant to use the radios for unofficial chat, and reached for her phone to call him instead. There was no signal in Cannock Chase Forest, but she could call him over Wi-Fi. "How's it going?" she asked when he picked up. "Dull as my cousin's stag do," Patrick said. "You know, the one where we all had to stand around and watch him practice his golf swings? You?" "Nothing much," Lily said. "Thought I saw something, but it turned out to be roadkill. I should be so lucky." "Are you going crazy in the forest by yourself, Lil?" "Maybe," Lily said. She liked Patrick a lot. She definitely didn't approve of workplace romances. They were cops, for goodness sake. They had to be realistic. But his voice over the phone was comforting, and his face across a briefing room always made Lily slightly less interested in what was being said and slightly more inclined to think about asking him out for a drink. They chatted for a while longer, Patrick telling her about the thrilling sights and sounds of the Milford Industrial Estate he'd stopped to eat his sandwich at. There was nothing really to share, but having the moment of human contact was something. When they hung up, Lily pulled away and began the slow, circular route again, driving at a snail's pace through the rain, trying to keep her eyes peeled for any sign of life. The second child was in the centre of Post Office Lane, right in Lily's rearview mirror. She must have stepped into the road just as Lily drove past. There were 2 of them, Lily saw as she jerked on the handbrake and brought the car to a stop. One of them was very small, and she was half hidden behind the other. Lily reached for the radio, but a sudden blinding stab of pain flashed through her head and sinuses. White spots swam in front of her eyes. She tried to focus, looking at the steering wheel, her hands, anything, but her vision was blurring. In the mirror, she could see the 2 children coming towards the car. Something about the slow, purposeful way they were walking made Lily hesitate before unlocking the doors. Her head hurt and her breath was coming in shallow pants as it did before she was going to be sick. What was wrong with her? Had she forgotten to eat something before she'd come out on patrol? It was a feeling like fear, she realised. A loud noise echoed through the car. One of the children, the taller one, had slammed her hands against the back window. Shaking, Lily picked up her radio. 1078, need assistance. Cannock Chase Patrol, over, she said. She felt jittery, out of control, even though she was a trained officer and these were only two children. Where were they? She couldn't see them in the mirror anymore. Lily craned around in her seat to look out of the back window, but the children weren't there. When she turned back around, her head feeling as though a pickaxe had been driven into it between her eyes, one of the children was right outside the driver's window. Afterwards, it would be difficult for Lily to put into words the feeling of intense, all-consuming fear which gripped her. The little girl's eyes were black, treacherous black ice on a frozen road in a chalk-white face. She was only small. She barely came up over the edge of the car door, so Lily couldn't see if she was smiling or in distress. All she could see were those black eyes drilling into her. Lily squeezed her eyes shut, then almost screamed when her radio buzzed. Lil, come in. Are you okay? Over. It was Patrick's voice. Slowly, Lily opened her eyes. She couldn't see the little girl next to her window anymore, and there was no sign of the other one. She picked up the radio. Yeah, I started feeling ill, she said. Migraine or something, I think. I might need to come off shift. Over. Give me a minute to clear it and I'll come down there. Over, he said. Okay. Lily made herself drink some water. What was wrong with her? Why was her heart pounding and her palms sweaty, and where had this sudden piercing headache come from? And why was she seeing children? And she was fairly sure there were no children there to see. There was something happening here tonight, but Lily had no idea what it was. The pain in her head made her less inclined to find out than usual. She pulled away, torturously slowly, the rhythmic sway of the windscreen wipers sounding loud as a pneumatic drill in her throbbing head. The last child was standing by the junction of Pentridge Bank and Birch's Valley. She was the smallest, and she waved at Lily. Like the others, her face was white as chalk, and she was wearing a pale dress which looked as though it was made of the same flimsy nylon as Lily's grandmother's dressing gowns, the kind that was used a long time ago. Her eyes were almost completely black from edge to edge. Lily rolled the car right up to the child and wound the window down. Her headache was almost blinding. Will you take me home? The little girl said. I need a lift. Of course, sweetheart, Lily said, even though the child was barely dressed despite the freezing night. There was some quality in her black eyes which made Lily unable to look away from them. It was as though she was falling into those eyes and drowning in tar. Get in the back and I'll take you. Where's home? She unlocked the back doors so the girl could climb into the car. Her radio buzzed again. Lil, I'm on my way, Patrick said. Are you okay? What's your position? Look, don't drive anymore, okay? Wait, I'll talk to you in a minute, Lily said and cut the channel. The little girl had climbed into the patrol car. With her came a damp smell, like soil and leaf mulch and something older and darker, the sharp scent of something which never should have been there. Her black eyes met Lily's in the rearview mirror. It's not far, the little girl said, pointing down the Birches Valley Road. That way. Despite the stabbing pain behind her eyes, Lily put her headlights up and turned the car down Birches Valley.
I'm Sergeant Shaw. What's your name? Where have you been tonight, sweetheart? She asked the girl. Why aren't you at home now? I got lost, the girl said, almost dreamily, not really answering Lily's questions. I got lost, but it's time to go home now. Lily drove along the lane, until the black-eyed girl suddenly said, Here! The entrance to the track was almost invisible, but closer inspection showed Lily the broken pieces of a rusty five-bar gate, half hidden behind overgrown brambles. It might have been the entrance to a farm. It was thickly lined with trees, creating a kind of black, leafy tunnel. This is your home? Lily said doubtfully. The child answered by opening the car door and scrambling out. She stood next to the car, a little way from it, so she was waiting for Lily. Lily killed the engine and got out. You were looking, the little girl said, and the expression on her face suddenly made her look much older. You were looking, and now you'll find. Lily took a step towards her, meeting her impossibly black eyes. But just like that, the child simply and suddenly was not there. Lily would never be able to explain the sensation adequately. There was no lurch of the world on its axis, no ripple of change, no rush of tiny feet or rustle of the bushes. The little black-eyed girl simply ceased to exist. Lily looked down the narrow track, and she knew what she had to do. Her headache had lifted, curiously, as though it had never been there. Lily grabbed the radio from the car, called in her position, and asked for backup again. Lily, what's going on? Patrick's distorted voice crackled across the channel. Just get here, she said, clipping the radio to her jacket. Then she made her way down the narrow track, not daring to use her torch in case it gave her away. Now the painful haze behind her eyes had lifted, she felt no fear, not even a little. There was just an extraordinary sense of clarity that she'd been brought here by those children, whoever they might be, to do a job. You were looking, and now you'll find. The track was long, and Lily almost missed the point where it veered off sharply as the turning was covered with thick brambles. Not caring that she scratched her hands, she pulled them aside. Just beyond, in a little clearing, there was a corrugated iron shed. It looked shabby, abandoned, like a farm outbuilding which had been long forgotten. There were no lights inside, and there was a shining new padlock on its door. Lily ignored the door and picked up a piece of wet wood to smash the window. It was a single pane of glass and broke easily. Then she heard a voice. Help me. Please help me. I want to go home. Her hand now steadier than it had ever been, Lily clicked on her torch and shone it through the window. She saw the little girl on the floor first, dressed in a dirty blue tracksuit. She was terrified and shivering violently, but she looked as though she was in one piece. The smell hit Lily next. That old smell of fear and suffering. There were dark patches on the floor which might have been urine or might have been blood. And on the walls. Lily did not linger over long on those photographs. Pictures which belonged locked away in an evidence room or in the heart of a bonfire. She'd seen enough to make the call. The girl's mother had only just reported her missing. It had only been a few short hours. When the armed response unit arrived and cut the padlock, the girl rushed into Lily's waiting arms. Patrick arrived soon after, and the three sat in his car together drinking lukewarm tea while forensics moved in. They caught the man not long after, coming on foot to that little shed in the forest where he'd murdered Caroline Blackwater and Alba Johnson. He'd looked like anyone, DCI Harris said. Just another dog walker. But Lily had caught sight of him as they brought him into the station, and she thought she would have known what he was and what he'd done. It was his eyes, she thought. They were strangely blank, as though he'd been thinking of nothing at all when he'd killed those children. And they were far more horrible than the black eyes of the children of Cannock Chase. Lily never drove the forest beat again, but she never heard of anybody seeing the little girls with their dark eyes either. She didn't know entirely what she had seen that night, but she knew it had stopped at least one other child being hurt. Afterwards, all she would ever say was that she'd been in the right place at the right time. And that was all anybody could get out of her.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It was late January when Mr. Strines finally clambered into his motor car and took the long drive north to Middleton by Yulegrave. An antique bookseller of some renown, Strines was resident at Mag's Brothers Bookshop in Berkeley Square. Mag's remains a fine London establishment famed for both its trade since 1853 in rare books and manuscripts, and since the 1840s, the legendary Nameless Horror, which once haunted its upstairs apartments. The hauntings at No. 50 Berkeley Square, with the associated death from terror of Sir Robert Warboys, the creeping madness which corrupted the subsequent resident, Thomas Myers, several maids, and the famed 1872 hunting trip to catch the Nameless Horror by Lord Littleton, further embellished the building's reputation. None would live in those apartments, and while book sales continued below, it lived above, shrouded in mystery. That was until 1930, when Strine's grandfather, Ludovico, a German emigre, pianist and occult historian, solved the riddle. Whatever he did to cleanse the malevolent spirit, he never spoke of it, though rumours still swirled. The being was said to have manifested as anything from a seething, tentacled demon to a vast and ominous man-shaped shadow. Either way, since Ludovico's great feat of banishment, members of the Strines family had been gifted the use of the attic at 50 Berkeley Square in perpetuity. By the time of the death of Ludovico Strines, his son, Otto, was already happily ensconced in Golders Green with his wife, Matilda, and their son, Dieter, along with three other children. In later years, Dieter and his father grew apart, feuding over matters of faith, heritage and money, but most fractious was Otto's insistence on controlling Dieter's chosen vocation. While a talented pianist himself, Otto Strines ultimately made his living through owning apartment stores. He was a successful entrepreneur and sought for his son to attend the Royal Academy of Music and become the great piano player of his age. Alas, while he played beautifully, Dieter truly only cared for his grandfather's other curiosities. He would leaf through the old man's ancient books, his pages of scribbled notes and collections of Orphic apparatus, his shelves of dusty crystals and homemade arcane tools. It was perhaps unsurprising, then, that when, after a particularly heated quarrel, Dieter stormed out of his father's house, never to return. He took a steamer trunk filled not with sheet music, but his grandfather's rarest occult treasures. These he moved to the long empty apartment in the attic at 50 Berkeley Square, making it his home, never playing the piano again. In the years that followed, Dieter, or Mr. Strines, as he was known to all who made his acquaintance, became a person to whom people turned in times of particular trouble. Stacks of his business cards might still be found beneath the counter at Atlantis Books, Watkins or Treadwell's, along with other such occult booksellers up and down England. Across his long life and career, he encountered all number of spooks and spectres, monstrous beasts and strange apparitions. This earned him a reputation for the discreet and sensitive handling of arcane phenomenon, though in his latter years he focused on his primary means of income, the selling of rare books, which he did with great pleasure and personal sensitivity. Quite how Mr. Strines came to be contacted by Jacob Kendall remained somewhat of a mystery, even as he drove north. Strines' dealings in Derbyshire had been scant over the years, though his grandfather's assistance of John Henry Montagu Manners, the 9th Duke of Rutland, in exercising the worst manifestations at Haddon Hall had led to a long association between the two families. When Lord Edward, brother of the present Duke, had called on Mr. Strines to purge the last remaining spirit of the place, that of the wronged mistress, Dorothy Vernon, he had, of course, complied. Though that was almost a decade ago. What business Lord Edward might have with a man like Jacob Kendall, Mr. Strines could not hope to guess. But his letter had been warm and piqued Strines' curiosity, so he, of course, replied. The issue at hand was a set of three ancient cottages at Spore, a now abandoned hamlet in a quiet Derbyshire valley. Jacob Kendall was a builder, hired to demolish the cottages and construct a new electricity substation. Only no sooner had Mr. Kendall set about beginning his work than the disturbances began. The noises of people tramping up and down stairs in heavy clogs, the sound of chairs and other articles of furniture being moved. This was all in spite of the cottages having been abandoned 40 years before. Their roofs and ceilings had fallen in. The buildings had no upper or lower floors, no staircases, and absolutely no furniture. As Mr. Kendall had explained in his letters, he persevered undeterred, all until an apparition made itself known. It was a little girl of apparently 3 or 4 years of age, wearing a buff nankeen bonnet, and it offered him a handful of gold. Wisely, Mr. Kendall had retreated from the place, seeking such advice as led to Mr. Strines. This had been a sage choice, as the ghost of a child is never what it appears to be. Indeed, should he have accepted that gold, Strines knew, then Mr. Kendall's fate would have taken a dark turn, perhaps irrevocably so. Mr. Strines shunned all things electrical on account of their interference with his instruments as well as his mind, so he had corresponded with Mr. Kendall by letter, as was his way. Missives were exchanged throughout the autumn of 2023, Strines making arrangements to visit Spore in the new year. His journey north had initially been planned for shortly after Christmas, but was delayed on account of storms Henk and Aisha. This meant it was almost Imok by the time he'd made the trip, ensconced in his trusty Sunbeam Tiger, a classic motor car he kept running at great expense. He was, at the time, aged 71, and dressed in a warm woolen suit, wrapped in a thick overcoat, scarves, gloves, and 8-piece cap of Donegal tweed, all chosen to guard against the cold. By this time, Mr. Strines was, of course, semi-retired. His hair was thin, teeth worse for wear, but he was otherwise healthy. He joked that this was because he'd never married, although he had loved many men and many women across his several decades, a new heartbreak as well as anyone. Still, he considered himself lucky to have avoided the many complications associated with matrimony, including children and home ownership. He was instead content with his work, not least his books, and dined with friends, making weekend visits to those corners of England where he'd never encountered a demon, ghoul, or creature of darkness to spare himself from painful memories. He thought to take this case because it seemed simple enough, and had set out before dawn, travelling up the M1 via Luton, Leicester and Derby. He knew Mr. Kendall would be unable to meet him until the late afternoon, but the builder had kindly arranged for Strines to meet a Mr. Winsford, a member of the local historical society at the village stone at the heart of Middleton by Yulgrave that morning, for a walk about the outlines of the parish. As Strines drove into Middleton, he wondered whether it might be possible to find a more attractive, less spoilt village in the whole of the Peak District. Situated on an unclassified loop road, it was out of the way, yet only a short distance from one of Derbyshire's loveliest dales and surrounded by excellent walking country. This said, Strines was bemused to see, striding out onto the heath beside Raig Lane, a gentleman dressed in not a single stitch. Considering the temperature, which was brisk at best, Strines found himself smiling at the sight. While perhaps invigorating, taking such a bracing, naked ramble at the tail end of winter seemed foolhardy and a sure route to catching exposure. Strines slid the sunbeam down Middleton's spacious main street, which was lined with pretty limestone cottages, and came to a stop not far from the village square. He knew little of the traditions of the place, beside that the village held an annual well-dressing on the 25th of May, and that once a year, on the 10th of February, the long-closed pub, the Bateman Arms, was revived in the village hall. These quaint happenings, which he learned of via Kendall's letters, seemed suitably esoteric. Yet, as with everywhere in England, there was no doubt all manner of mysteries in the village's past. Having come to know far too much about so many like places, however, which had filled Strine's mind with so much history, in his latter days he'd become less inclined to read about them in advance. Rather, if commissioned to assist in a case, he would learn as little as possible until there, soaking up salient facts as he went, forgetting as much as he could as quickly as possible. It was, he thought, hard enough to remember friends' birthdays or where he'd left a given umbrella or walking cane. Besides, he needed no more reasons to lie awake in his room until dawn. As such, it was Strine's intention to let Mr. Winsford show him the village and its curiosities, but to have the experience wash over him like he were a rock in a flowing stream. And when he parked up and climbed out of the sunbeam, he was pleased to see a gentleman much the same age as himself sat on a bench beside the village stone, so he strode over to make his introductions. "Mr. Winsford, I presume," Strine said. As he did, however, he felt the hairs rise on his forearms, which was never a good sign. The old man on the bench said nothing, though he turned to Strines as if slightly perplexed. This new acquaintance then stood and Strines observed him. He was dressed in a green cardigan and brown trousers, which were tucked into walking boots. His eyes were blue, his cheeks pale, and his silver hair mid-length and tousled by the wind. In response to his silence, Strines spoke again, rubbing his forearms, though far from cold. "Mr. Kendall said you would meet me and show me the highlights. He said something of the sights of meaning. And, of course, I must see Arbelow." "Arbelow," the old stranger said. "Aye, and the sights of meaning."
"Is this place..."
"Well, no matter. Come on, then. Let's bobby off." Strines looked back at his car, considering whether he ought to bring more with him. He already had a tuning fork in his pocket, which was a bare essential, but the rest of his equipment was in the steamer trunk on the Sunbeam's back seat. Likewise, his luggage. Yet he knew the bed and breakfast where he'd booked to stay would not be ready for him until later that day, so shrugged off the unsettling feeling. He nonetheless implored Mr. Winsford to wait for a moment. The old man did just that, standing some way off and watching as Strines changed into his trusty rambler's boots and pulled his long walking stick from its place in the rear footwell. Carved of hazel, the staff was as tall as Strines, a space in its head socketed for varying purposes. At present, it was embedded with an orb of black obsidian, and no sooner had he touched it than he felt his nerves calm and the uneasy sensation melting away. "And what have you got there?" the old man said on seeing it peering from a distance. "Ah," Strines replied, "in my line of work you can never be too careful, not least when the ground's wet. Don't want to slip. Now, lay on, Macduff, and damn be him that first cries, hold, enough!" Mr. Winsford was evidently not, Strines thought, a man of letters. Instead of smiling, he turned and began striding away, on towards Roughwood Hollow, speaking roughly over his shoulder. "Houses there," he said, pointing to either side of the broad main street, "built in 1820 by Thomas Bateman. I presume you know of Mr. Bateman?" "Oh, yes," Strines replied, "a famed barrow delver, member of the British Archaeological Association, and, if I'm not mistaken, author of The Vestiges of the Antiquities of Derbyshire, a fine volume worth a pretty penny if in good condition. Called himself the Barrow Knight. Dug up near 300 tombs in his day. Buried yonder with his child, Sarah, in a lonely spot, up the hill behind the chapel of St. Michael and All Angels. In quietness and in confidence shall be your strength." "Isaiah 30:50, Strines replied, bemused. The old man had stopped walking, and Strines noticed he was now pointing to a carved stone seat. Strines looked at it, presuming it was intended for use by weary walkers trudging up from Bradford Dale. Then he spied, engraved in the granite, the quote from the scripture his companion had just muttered. "Well, well," Strines said, inclined to take out his spectacles for closer inspection. "How curious." Though when he turned to look, he saw that the old man had already walked on. Realising there was no time to pause, Strines followed. As he did, he thought Mr. Winsford strangely quiet, the old man saying nothing until they were midway across the Bradford Dale Bridge. "Still glides the stream, and shall forever glide," he murmured. "The form remains, the function never dies." Strines nodded, noting that, again, this quote, which came from Wordsworth, was also carved into a stone seat. This one was midway across the stone bridge, its sides worn smooth through use. Strines inhaled deeply, enjoying the moment, for the air was filled with the sounds of running water and of the wind teasing at the trees. He thought it a beautiful spot to sit and rest, so made remarks to that effect, saying, "Quite the place, Mr. Winsford." No reply was forthcoming, however, for Mr. Winsford was already gone, his shape disappearing off down a nearby lane. The walk continued in much the same manner for the rest of the morning, including a stop at an ancient sheep dip, where, in late May or June, generations of farmers had brought their flocks to wash their fleeces. It was, Strines thought, a hard, cold, murky place, and he was unsettled when the hairs on his forearms again stood on end. This was in spite of the obsidian orb in the head of his staff, a sure sign that the spot was haunted. So much so, in fact, that his head began to ache. Of this sensation, Strines said nothing, feeling Mr. Winsford was not a man inclined towards superstition. Strines watched him, trudging on through the damp leaves and by bare trees, and touched at the case in his breast pocket. He had no cause to open it, he thought, but he was reassured to know it was there. On they ventured, down the pathway between Rollo Dale and the road to Smerrel, the view overlooking Rusden Wood. When they came to the old Clapper Bridge, again they stopped, spying another engraved seat. This one, a quote from Pope, it read, "Consult the genius of the place in all that tells the waters to rise or fall." "Men came and said no such inscription were to be made," Mr. Winsford announced. "But the bridge were broke and down to just one channel. We fixed it, laid the slab. Local folk are the authority here. Besides, there's a boggart. not that outsiders would know to look. Broken things only make them stronger. A boggart? Strines replied. He acted surprised, but had guessed as much from the sweat on the back of his neck, the bristling hairs on his forearms, and the steady ache which had developed behind his left eye.
Aye, a brownie turned bad. A large something. Long ears, horns and tail, glides by and vanishes out of sight. No trouble, not that one at least.
The old man once again walked off, striding quickly away from Mr. Strines, who followed on as they passed down Lowfield Lane to Rollo Brook. Strines thought it strange that Winsford mentioned it, not least as it was common knowledge that to mention a boggart only made it stronger. Still, they continued to walk in a silence which felt frosty and unkind. So, as they made their way, Strines risked a new line of conversation, hoping to warm the mood of his new associate.
"You know, Mr. Winsford," Strines said, "driving into the village this morning, I saw the strangest thing. There was a gentleman walking up onto the dale naked," came the reply. "Aye, Mr. Higginson, John. Died 1876. Was a peddler in his day. Likes to show people his backside."
"Ah," Strines said, nodding. Winsford was clearly disinclined to say more on the subject, yet this admission, along with the mention of the Clapper Bridge boggart, did at least make clear that the old man was a believer. This reassured Strines, for, though he had only come to Middleton by Yulegrave to help Mr. Kendall with his issue at Spore Cottages, he knew that any village with this many spectral inhabitants had to hold a deeper set of secrets. A local historian would be a useful resource, though Strines felt it likely that all these phenomena pertained to Arbor Low, a site he'd never visited but had read of a great many times. Located in the midst of the White Peaks, the monument dated from 2500 BC. It took the same form as nearby Bull Ring at Dove Holes, Cairnpapal Hill and Stenness Stones in Scotland, and Wiltshire's Avebury Ring. Containing 43 stones, many broken to fragments and all laid flat but one, it was encircled by a ditch 7 feet deep and 33 feet wide. This was bisected by 2 causeway entrances which aligned with sunrise on Midsummer, as did the 6 stones known as the Cove. These slabs formed what was said to be a central altar of long-forgotten use, and this basic formation was repeated time and again at monuments across the country. Likewise, the earth dug up to form ditches at monuments like these had been used to make cremation barrows. The Arbor Low example, known as Jib Hill. Though the site had not been excavated for over a century, Thomas Bateman, the barrow knight himself, had found bone and antler tools, flint scrapers and arrowheads beneath the earth. It was also reputed, Strines knew, to be crawling with boggarts, something he recalled from his research into St. Michael's Lay, back when he had sealed the weird stone at Glastonbury many years before. Strines had never been inclined to visit Arbor Low of his own volition, but he had read of its strange significance. Forming an exact Pythagorean triangle just 2 degrees north from Stonehenge, 1 degree east from Glastonbury, and a second with Killarnish megaliths in Scotland's Outer Hebrides, a third with Bryn Celli Dhu on the Isle of Anglesey, it was, he knew, the midpoint or heart of a ley line network. It was a place of ancient power whose language was lost even to him. But if past experiences were anything to go by, Arbor Low still wanted to speak, even if its utterances would not be understood. Strines was shaken from his contemplations by a sudden and almighty roar. It was that of 2 vast motor engines. They were thundering overhead, yet low, so low as to make Strine's flesh quake and his bones shudder. Gripping his staff, he spun on his heels, staring into the white grey sky. And there he saw it, to his amazement, a Vickers Wellington bomber, a long-range aircraft belching black smoke and falling slowly but surely out of the sky. "By the heavens!" Strines exclaimed, watching as the plane sailed, droning, down from above and headlong towards the cold earth of a nearby field. He listened for the sound of the crash, looked to see the flames rising and trail of smoke, but none were forthcoming. He turned then to look at Mr. Winsford, who was stood down the lane and staring back, seemingly disinterested. "He came down on 21st of January 1944. Killed six. Royal Australian Air Force, but here's what we're here to see." Heart thundering, Strines approached the old man, moving off further down the track, and there, nestled in the hedgerow, Strines saw it. A granite hand, carved in the manner of so many guide stoops across Derbyshire. Below it, there was another quotation, etched into the stone, which Strines read aloud. "To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." William Blake, he thought, from the Auguries of Innocence. Macabre verse, though few ever read it in full. Again he touched his breast pocket, quickening his pace as Mr. Winsford had long since wandered on. Their subsequent route took them along the path to Longdale, by the Boulderstone, and up to Fryden Bends. The quote there came from Heraclitus: "The road up and the road down are one and the same." Strines knew this particular piece of wisdom to be a lie, but did not remark upon it. By then, the pair had walked several miles, and though Strines was hungry, he hung back a little, watching Mr. Winsford from afar. Indeed, he slowed his pace to a near crawl at the point where Green Lane crossed the path of the old Roman road, after which they finally started journeying north, on towards Arbor Low. As Strines walked, he kept one eye on Mr. Winsford, but also stared out into Middleton Common. It was there that he spied another horror, though did not mention it. This was, he considered, among the most disturbing examples he'd seen in recent years. Having always been slightly unsettled by infants with their rounded features, wet lips, and shiny little eyes, he knew, even in his youth, that he could never make a good father. Then, when he saw apparitions of children, as he had many times, he assured himself that entities chose such shapes to appear innocent, as if they were vulnerable, intending to fool those mortal souls they were hoping to entrap. On this occasion, it was the ghost of a baby. Unclothed, yet blood-spattered, it was crawling across the rough scrub of the heath, mewling as if in pain. Strines glanced at it, a tiny, white shape struggling along through the rough ground. Its bandy legs and knees moved awkwardly as it crawled, though the grasses did not shift where it passed. He tried to look away to focus on Winsford, but his eye was drawn back to it again and again. That was until an invisible hand seemed to grasp the child's left back leg and lift it into the air, swinging it about before slamming the tiny shape down onto the turf. Strines shut his eyes at the last moment, unable to watch, listening to the bottom of his staff clacking on the ground as he walked. Then, when he opened his eyes again, the apparition had vanished. Strines considered the period when he knew such things happened, the killing of infants, and wondered if there had once been a castle at Middleton. This was as, during the Civil War, both the Roundheads and Royalists were wont to kill the children of their enemies by such violent means before leaving the bodies displayed on pikes as warnings to any standing against them. Though the circular walk around Middleton's sites of meaning continued on from Arbor Low, Mr. Strines never made it along the route south of Lathkill Dale to the Bugle Stone or up to the path on from Cale's Farm to Long Rake. If he had, he would have seen the buildings of Castle Farm, built using the ruins of Middleton Castle. That had been the building where Sir Christopher Fulwood mounted a defence against just such a roundhead invasion. Sir Christopher had raised an army of lead miners to fight for the king, but when they were surprised, his soldiers fled. During the raid, Cromwell's forces shot Sir Christopher, and he too then escaped to the top of the dale. There he hid in a crevice in a cliff and was discovered days later, having died from his injuries. After that rout, Middleton Castle was broken down, the stone used in the construction of many buildings around the village, not least Castle Farm, though the earthworks still stand in the field opposite Chapel House. And Mr. Strines would have remarked on them, had he made it that far, considering the final inscription at that spot, which reads, "Live as if you'll die tomorrow. Farm as if you'll live forever." This was an old Derbyshire saying, the first part of which was an adage Steins had lived by ever since his young manhood. Instead, however, his journey ended at Arbour Low. For it was there, as he approached the vast circular dyke, that he found his reticent companion waiting, beckoning him inside. "Quite the walk," the old man said, offering the first smile of the day. "But we've made good time. The sun's only now starting to come down." Strines stared up at the clouds, feeling the wind whip suddenly so much colder. "So," Strines said, "here we are, the famous Arbour Low. Aye, come into the ring, I must show you the cove." Strines licked his teeth beneath his lips, almost stumbling. For at that moment, not only did his forearms tickle with prickling hairs, but the back of his neck was hot, his head ached, and he heard his blood rushing in his ears. He made his way forward uneasily, leaning on his staff to stay upright, for he felt dizzy, though he approached the cove and the figure of the old man standing behind it. The six stones there were laid out in a rectangle, much like a coffin, yet the grass all about was cut short. This meant that the whole body of a man could lie comfortably within the cove. This was likely why, Strines thought, the grass of that place looked lush, much like the turf at Stonehenge, Avebury, Cairnpapel Hill and Stenness Stones. It had been fed for so many years, and not just with sun and rain. "Come," said the old man, still smiling. "Kneel and look into the cove. What you'll see there is the greatest marvel of this whole place." His jaws clenched, Strines smiled grimly, laying down his staff and making his way to one knee. He grunted, spying in the middle of the cove nothing but grass, neatly trimmed and waiting. He looked around himself then, out of the corners of his eyes, and saw a dozen or so shapes moving through the half-dark. The naked form of John Higginson, the dark something with its long ears, horn and tail. The six airmen stood, their blank eyes staring, while the baby crawled slowly nearer on its hands and knees. Elsewhere amongst their number, he spied ancients in furs brandishing clubs, the shape of what must have been Sir Christopher Fulwood, gut-shot yet smiling. Thomas Bateman, too, dressed in black mourning clothes. His daughter, Sarah, was by his side in a high-collared pinafore dress, looking to have tears in her eyes. The boggarts formed a circle around the ring of Arbour Low, then advanced as one, stepping down into the ditch and walking ever nearer, step by patient step. "And so," Strine said, looking up at the fiend who had led him there, "am I to suppose that, after all this, you are not, in fact, Mr. Winsford?" "I never said I was," it said, kicking away Strine's staff. The spectre shuddered as it did so, baring long, jagged teeth and losing its shape for a moment. It grimaced at its nearness to the obsidian, emitting a waft of dark smoke which smelled, ever so slightly, of brimstone. Strines nodded, then reached into his pocket and retrieved the case. The boggart watched him, curious and uncomprehending, as Strines unfastened the clip on its side and removed the tuning fork. It was made of quartz, heavy and old, and was tuned to G, the holiest note mankind has ever known. "Well," Strines said, peering about as the shapes re-emerged over the lip of the dike, "whoever, or whatever you are, I bid you and your companions here, adieu." Strines struck the pitchfork against the stone beneath his knee, and the note rang out, clear as fresh spring water. The shapes about the ring paused, halted their progress, hissing in fury. Again, Strines struck the quartz against the rock. He saw the boggarts stare at one another, all perplexed, their eerie shapes misting at the edges. The infant began to cry, and Strines chuckled grimly. "Now, now," he said, "no nearer, and no need for tears." As the note echoed away, Strines stood tall before reaching down and grasping his staff. The being nearest him, the entity he'd once thought Mr. Winsford, tried to flee. But Strines raised the hazel rod and struck the tuning fork once again, this time on the wood itself. The forms of the ghouls about him began to loosen and buckle, frozen in place. So Strine strode quickly towards the single upright in the middle of Arbor Low. He clanged the pitchfork against it, then put the base of his staff against the stone and, with a slight bow to the macabre company, touched the fork's quartz tines to the sphere of obsidian in the staff's top. The sacred sound passed through the gem, down the wood, and into the upright stone. From there, it spread out through the earth of the ancient ring, its echo humming in each of the fallen stones. This sacred geometry, Strines thought, was as much as he understood of these places, and he thanked his lucky stars for it. Because, as if at the click of a finger, the boggarts of Arbolo then vanished as one, like a blazing candelabra extinguished by a single mighty breath. Strines sighed, knowing this would not hold them for long. In a day or two, perhaps less, depending on their power, the spirits would reform. By then, however, he intended to be long gone, and sooner rather than later. Turning on his heels, he took the fastest route back to Middleton by Yulegrave. On foot, this took him across the common. It was dark, so he took great care not to fall or break an ankle on a rabbit warren. And though he was weary, with no pub open to offer food, a fire, or a stiff drink, he decided to simply head to the car. He would pick up a sandwich from the service station on his route home, letting the electric light bathe him in a pool of frenzied static. As he walked, he concluded he would have to write to Mr. Kendall and make his apologies, likewise to the real Mr. Winsford, presuming there ever had been a kindly historian who'd waited in the village square for much of the morning expecting his arrival. Nonetheless, Strines would have to send kind words and pass on recommendations that Kendall try another specialist in the field, Spencer and Associates perhaps, or Henrietta Swan, if she was still in business. With night truly fallen, Mr. Strines reached the sunbeam, unlocked it, and opened the driver's side door. He tossed his cap onto the old steamer trunk and climbed inside without changing his boots. After slotting his staff into the passenger side footwell, so it was within easy reach, he opened the glove box. From within, he extracted one of many sticks of sage, and this he lit using the car's cigarette lighter. Placing the sage into the cup holder behind the gear stick, he watched the smoke rise and sighed. It would have to do. Though once home, he intended to complete a grander cleansing ritual, just in case any of them had got close enough to form a bond. It was unlikely, he knew, but possible. Though one thing was for sure, he would never again return to Arbor Low.
Meh, meh. good Santa, bring gentlemen, such hounds, such hawks, and such leman, with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.